and welcome to another episode of the Albion Raw here on Radio Reverb 97.2 FM, online at RadioReverb.com, on DAB, and of course on our podcast. I'm Aidy Packham, and we're trying to work out exactly where our seats are in association with OldFootballShirts.com. Well, the new season got off to a great start as we came from behind to a somewhat controversial goal to beat Burnley 2-1 and return to civilization with 3 points. That sets us up nicely for today's visit of Watford for a game that, in terms of raw emotion, could not match the visit of Doncaster 10 years ago as friends, family and nodding acquaintances returned to a capacity Amex for the first time in 18 months. In other news, former Albion hero Tommy Elphick has hung up his boots at the age of 33. Joining me today as we cast an eye over the week's events is, of course, Alan Wares, and we're delighted to welcome a raw virgin in the shape of North Stand Collective's finest, Tom Hylands. Welcome to the Raw, Tom. Obviously, you are a raw virgin, so that means you've got to tell us all about your Albion supporting history.
Yeah, okay. So it goes back not as far as a lot. I got my introduction to the Albion through the Scouts, actually. Our Scout leader was a big Albion fan. So when the games fell on a Friday night, that's what we ended up doing so that he could go to the game as well. So I think first game, I was trying to work it out, and I think it was a 2-2 draw back in 2001 against who was it? It was some northern team that we should have beaten but didn't. I think it was a red card late on.
This is
Chesterfield. That's it.
Chesterfield. Yes.
Hang on.
Yes.
Did you say 2002?
I think so. Yeah. Where I think someone got sent off.
Was it an evening game?
Yeah, Friday evening.
Right. I remember this. This is the infamous one, AD, that Paul Rogers got sent off.
Yes.
For 7 minutes coming on after as a sub. Do you remember?
Isn't that the one when Michelle got his head like put through a Coke machine or something?
No, you wouldn't put your head through Michelle's head through a Coke machine, believe me. I think he tried to save everyone else from having their heads caved in. You actually came, your first game then, Tom, is probably one of the most infamous. I mean, I don't know if you know the back history to it. It's obviously the previous season we pipped Chesterfield to the fourth division title. Yeah. And because they'd had points deductions, they were complaining that they're the real champions, even though we actually overhauled their points deduction as well to win. And of course, it was about the last week of that season where we beat them in order to overhaul them. So they're smarting. And then it comes to this game that you're talking about. So we're talking November, December 2001, yeah. Something like that. And I think we actually go 2-0 up. Paul Rogers comes on as a sub, clatters someone. And a few minutes later, nearly gets them, but you can see the Chesterfield bench all screaming, you know, stay down, stay down. Referee falls for it. Second yellow, on your bike, son. You know, Rogers gets his marching orders. And anyone who was anyone, and we've spoken to several people about this, AD.
Including Paul Rogers.
Ted Rogers, we've spoken to Michelle, we've spoken to Bob Booker, Gary Hart, Kerry Mayo. They sort of... There's this kind of embarrassed glee with which they talk about this particular story. You know, embarrassed in as much as they're professional footballers and shouldn't misbehave, but glee with the, I think it was along the lines of the this was when the changing room floor collapsed.
I believe so. But yeah, I mean, Nicky Law was the Chesterfield manager, wasn't he? It was, I think that was this up? This was after we won the league, wasn't it?
Yeah. If you, so, a few minutes ago.
And the brown envelopes being passed around with these.
Chesterfield
was a baptism of fire for sure.
What were the circumstances that you got to go to the game then?
It was literally because it was on a Friday night and Scouts was on Friday, so. Our scout leader wanted to go to the games when they fell on Fridays instead of running a proper scout session. So we always just went to the game. Yeah. And that happened throughout kind of that time. So went to all sorts of games and they all seemed to be draws or losses from memory. Didn't have a great record back then. But that kind of just transformed into a love of the Albion. come from a rugby family predominantly, so never got the chance to go to games outside of that, and just kind of grew from there. And I suppose with the NSK, it was actually a weird chance meeting in Geneva for the pre-season friendly that we had out there that kind of introduced me to them.
Geneva, yeah. You make it sound as though you're sort of part of some international crime fighting thing, like, you know, the Champions or the Thunderbirds, the Persuaders. So hang on. So which one are you? Are you Alan Tracy?
No, definitely not.
Geneva, do tell then.
So, basically went out with my mate, didn't know the NSK or any of them at that point. It was quite a fun pre-season because the game actually got confirmed really late on. So everyone had booked their flights, hotels, knew a couple of people that booked their hotel right next to the main stadium in Geneva, thinking, you know, we're gonna play the main team out there. You know, we're in the championship, all of that. Turns out we're playing a fourth division Swiss team on the other side of the city, near the Hadron Collider. But literally was out there, and some randomer came up, tapped me on the shoulder and went, "You're Tom Hylands, aren't you?" I was like, okay, yeah, I can be. And it basically just turned into, saw your picture on Twitter, recognised you. Definitely not creepy at all.
If you're in Geneva, some bloke didn't say you're Tom Hylands. That's far too direct. He said, "The geese fly south over Moscow tonight."
It was something like that. I might be simplifying it. But
Are you Red Fox? Are you Red Fox? Do you have the microfish? Do you have Do you have your football watching badge?
So you're in Geneva, mate. Yeah.
Yeah, and basically that turns into enjoying the game with this group of people. It turns out to be the group from the NSK that were out there following season. I think it must have been promotion season from there on. Just every week see them at the games, got ahead, more involved, and yeah, they're now like good mates and see them all the time.
So we'll talk about a bit more about the NSK and what it is in a moment, but continuing your Albion supporting history, I mean, you said your first game was about 20 odd years ago.
Yeah.
So in that time, I mean, one, were you particularly an Albion fan before that? I mean, you said you were a rugby fan.
Yeah.
But as a follow-up to that, in that case, if your Albion supporting history is just the 20 years, in the time you've been watching them, I want you to pick one, gun to head, pick one Albion player who stands out above all others.
One that stands out. God, there's so many iconic players. I'm going to go left field here and say Toko, because I bought a shirt with his name on the back, and that was the biggest mistake I've ever made in that history.
this is Nzuzi Toko, who played exactly how many games for us, Tom?
I don't think he actually played any, not even the League Cup or anything. Yeah, exactly.
I don't think he even made the bench. I think he might have made the bench in the League Cup game. I'll have to double check that.
I think he was lucky to make the bench in the under-23s, actually. But,
reality, who's your favourite player in those 20 years?
I have a soft spot for Richard Carpenter, because he's the first player, and I suspect that's a bit of a strange one considering the time that I started really watching the Albion. And I just think he's the first player that I kind of remember properly, and just his free kicks and his general kind of play in the middle was kind of what drew me to him. Yeah. So
there was a tackle that Chippy made in a game against Luton. I don't know if you remember it. It was absolutely stair-rodding it down. I mean, it was
where are we talking about?
This is at 15, right? And it was the worst weather I've ever seen, and the pitch was pretty much
regular 15 weather.
And I mean, Chippy just came in and he just slid for about 20. It was like he was on a water slide. I mean, the spray of water went up behind him. It was just one of those magnificent images. I mean, he missed the player and the ball. I mean, he just kept on going. I mean, it was like he was on a conveyor belt. It's brilliant.
Mike Newell.
Yeah, excellent.
That's an interesting one, isn't it? Chippy, he's someone, to be fair, AD, that we, in our sort of 15 years of doing this, he's become a little bit of a, not a forgotten character, but certainly an underrated, underappreciated sort of person. And, you know, sort of as the mists of time sort of pull away from those days, you know, where we talk about Bobby and Hearty and Watto and what have you, Chippy was at the middle of everything, wasn't he?
Yeah, I think that he was a pivotal part of those kind of formative years at the Wivdean, and kind of the amount of assists he had, the kind of contribution that he made to that team, as you say, is forgotten. And I think we need to remember these players as well, because they're so important in our history.
And he scored a lot of very important goals as well.
And also, he did also come up with probably one of the most terrifying sights I've ever seen on a pitch. He went up to an opponent and smiled at him.
Okay, speaking of smiles, that leads us neatly onto Burnley, where we came home smiling. But it was the first team sheet of the season, and it included a surprise inclusion of one Shane Duffy. Now, Tom, do you think this is a proper renaissance for Shane, or do you think he may well still be putting on someone else's shirt come September?
Well, I think for the time being, he's surely going to start. You know, we don't really seem to have any defenders. You know, I think we've got a chance of getting called up if the injury crisis goes much further. But it's a good opportunity for him to make that shirt his own again. I thought first half there was maybe a few nerves in there with Duffy, but as soon as we went to that back three and he was alongside Webster and Dunk, he was solid. He had such a good game, and it was like the Duncan Duffy combo of old.
Yeah, I mean, he had the most headed clearances of anyone in the league on Saturday.
Well, to be fair, against Burnley, that was most likely to happen, wasn't it?
Yeah. I mean, it should be said. I mean, sometimes all you need is a lucky break, and it's not lucky for Joel Weltman, who's had to isolate. But I mean, this could be the making of him. And the interview that Shane did after the game, the absolute raw honesty of it, and the fact of him having to say, "I've hit rock bottom and had to accept the reset button," it just endears you to him a little bit, doesn't it?
Well, the thing is, what you've got is from our show from a couple of weeks ago, where even at this early stage of the season, our predictions are already going horribly wrong. Where I said Østergaard is going to usurp Duffy's place, and that's the writing on the wall for him. And completely opposite has happened, albeit Østergaard has made a very, very good start at Stoke City. I'm delighted for Shane Duffy. You know, there is that thing of, the hinge and bracket relationship of Duffy and Dunk. It is one of those sort of, very manly, very masculine combinations that, you know, we can always look back on. And as Tom alluded to, the sort of like the men mountain of yore. But it's not necessarily someone who you could argue actually still fits into what we would term a Graham Potter system. But even then, as Brian Clough would tell you, he needed some bricklayers amongst his violin players to make his team work. So there is clearly a space for Shane Duffy. And at the moment, while Veltman and Byrne are on the Crocs list, then yeah, he's in a position to make hay while the sun shines, and playing like he did against Burnley. Yeah, it's Burnley. Watford are going to be a different thing, and then we've got all the other clubs. Everton again next week, different thing again. But you know, this is his chance to actually say to Graham, you know, I'm back. You know, and brilliant for him.
Yeah, and Tom, I mean, Graham Potter does tend to hit horses for courses, and as Al said, this was Burnley. We know they've got a big aerial threat. That's the way they like to play. And it was a perfect game for Shane to come back into and just basically give everyone a reminder that he's still there.
Yeah. And the other thing I think is it just shows the importance of Lewis Dunk in that team. You know, I think when Dunk is in that team, he brings that defensive performance up a level. I think if you look at some performances of some ex-players maybe last week, you know, I think that's a really vital.
That was the point I was going to make. I was going to say, just to take a side, do you think that he benefited from having Duncan Webster alongside him?
Oh, 100%. You know, I think for me, Duncan Webster were the standouts last season. Webster was shaky at best. on Saturday, to be fair, but he still was pivotal. It was his pass that created that second goal, really, for Gross to go. And I think it allows Potter to kind of have that style of play there, and gives them the freedom to go forward. And yeah, I think going forwards, I think that three at the back with Duffy in is much more solid. I think he may well struggle if it's just four at the back.
Yeah. Okay. I mean, I don't want to dwell too much on this, boys, but it's something else reared its ugly head again, and that was the Burnley fans. I believe there might have been a couple of Brighton fans involved in this as well, which is the booing of the taking of the knee. I mean, I just don't understand what the call for that actually is.
Tom?
No. I mean, you know, with the NSK, we're all about football for all and equality, and you know, don't want to see the booing. And, you know, it's something that needs education, I think, more than anything, as to why the players are booing. What I would say, though, is the boos did seem to get drowned out eventually. And there did seem, when I was looking around the stands, there was a lot of Burnley fans clapping as well. So I think, you know, we definitely need some progress, but it's not just about the boo in the knee. It's about kind of more inclusive chants and some of the more kind of general chants that get passed off as banter that actually I don't think there's place for that.
Did you still hear the homophobic chanting up there?
To be honest, I actually didn't hear anything much. There might have been some, but it definitely wasn't audible kind of the other side of the stand where I was.
Sure. Right. Okay. Well, I mean, it was very definitely a game of two halves, Tom, and but it was the worst possible start after just 2 minutes. I'm still scratching my head about how the goal was allowed to actually stand. So talk me through your view of it.
It's a two-handed shove. I mean, I think it's, yeah, you've got the argument that Morpay is just standing there, right? And Tarkowski has a right to go through him. But I think it's different. If Tarkowski's just running and Morpay falls on his backside because of that action, I think fair play, it's a goal. But Tarkowski takes two hands, moves them back, and there's a clear push forward. So he's made a decision to shove Morpay. And that for me is what makes it a foul.
Yeah. Okay, Al, I mean, what area on the pitch would you like to suggest that if it's where that would take place, it would be a foul and possibly even the booking?
What area? The big green one that's out
there. Oh, that's the one.
Yeah.
If it's the other way around, it's a penalty. If it's anywhere else on the pitch, it's a free kick.
Well, of course.
What
it reminded me of was what Neil Morpay was three stacked empty cardboard boxes and Tarkowski was a car from the Sweeney.
But I mean, a foul is a foul is a foul at the end of the day. Yeah. And I think we're all agreed that it actually was and the goal shouldn't have actually stood.
Well, there's
VAR had a very good weekend.
Sorry, I was about to say, I mean, this is the issue about the referees and VAR. And if, and it is an almighty if, the Premier League has taken on board how VAR was operated during the Euros, then, okay, fair enough. We've called for it. So therefore, we stand by it. I mean, I'd ask you, Adi, if that goal was allowed to, if that goal, sorry, was disallowed by Shane Duffy going crashing through one of the Burnley players, I'm trying to think of someone who is less than 6'4" wide, would you have actually screamed your head off about that as well at the same time?
Let me rewind a few years. I mean, this is a completely different kind of goal. But there was a Vicente goal at the Amex. I think it was against Hull a few years ago.
Actually, while I was crashing the entire...
Well, no, it was Adam Elad who made a big hole for himself in the wall which was blatantly
by playing at wrecking balls. Yeah, I remember.
Yeah, and I mean, obviously...
Did you call that a foul then? Did you call that as a foul then, AD?
I would have called that as a foul, and we sniggered it. The goal was allowed. But, I mean, as you would as a football fan, but you think, I've got away with one there. But in the hype, we didn't have VAR then.
And it was in the second division. But the other thing about it is, and this is where I'm going to get really technically nerdy, is if a lad did that before the free kick was taken, I'm not sure that it could have been called as a foul.
Although saying that, I mean, we had the goal disallowed last season for a perfectly good free kick by Dunk after the referee blew the whistle and that. So I think, you know, it's just, I think VAR in general, they need to pay attention to what that fan survey said at the back end of last season, because there is a lot of disgruntlement about it, and they're forgetting that football's not just on TV. You know, it's people in the stadium, and that's where their entire, you know, quote unquote product is based.
Yeah.
But that's been our mantra throughout most of lockdowns. Like, football isn't a TV show. It's a living, breathing thing that comes to life when people are in the stands.
The point is that we were calling for a lighter touch to refereeing. Not every single time a player went down was it automatically a foul. Now, Tom's point about it being a two-handed shove, if the cameras didn't pick up on it, that, you know, that it was like that, then yeah, there's a mistake. But what we're not talking about is the quality of VAR. We're talking about the quality of refereeing, whether it's on the pitch or whether it's out up at Stockley Park, and that is a slightly different issue to the points we were making about the refereeing in the Euros. With the Euros, we were talking about not being so easily fooled by a player going down or throwing his arms up in the air or whatever it is.
Yeah.
But we've still got to increase the quality of the refereeing with a very, very narrow time constraint, and they've got to make a quick decision. But using the technology properly and appropriately, and in that sense, you can argue that very little has been learned from the Euros.
I think that that's completely fair. And I think the Euros wasn't a demonstration of how good VAR can be. I think it was a demonstration of how far behind our referees have fallen compared to those on the continent. And I think you look at things like last season with not putting the flags up until late and kind of some of the decisions that are almost made with a view that, oh, VAR can pick it up if I was wrong. And it was almost used as an excuse and a backup rather than trying to get the decision correct the first time on the pitch so that there wasn't a need for VAR to come in.
It's a video assistant referee, not a video additional referee. And I think that's
But just while we're on VAR, I mean, there was a pretty nasty foul on Isma Suma from Gudmundsson, which was given a yellow. Was that the correct decision, do you think?
I think that one's a difficult one for me. Have you put a player in danger? Yes, you have. You know, yes, both have gone sliding in. It's a 50-50 challenge. Both have effectively won the ball, but, you know, he's left his boot in, studs up. It's dangerous where it's hit him.
Yeah, I mean, there was a nasty one from Tarkowski on Morpay where he elbowed him in the head as well, which last year they might have actually had a look at. I don't think they did this time, but like I said, I mean, it's a game of two halves, and Mwepu's Albion debut only lasted 45 minutes. He got hooked at half time. I think that we could see things weren't going right for us. It was a very poor performance in the first half. I mean, it was, you know, they hit the bar, they hit the post, and it could have been game over by that point, but we made changes and we were much better in the second period.
What changed, do you think, Tom? What could you see that made it so clear that we could do it in a different manner?
Partnerships. As soon as we went to three at the back, everyone seemed much more comfortable. The pitch seemed balanced. Kind of existing partnerships that have been built over the last couple of seasons were in play. So actually the passes were better. They knew where the space was and how to adapt to it. And it just felt like the first half was completely unbalanced. Webster didn't know whether to go forward or back. Gross as a left back is an experiment that probably shouldn't be repeated, because I think that free at the back just allows that much more freedom in players, and they're much more used to it and a greater understanding. And you could see that instantly.
Okay, but I mean, we talk about how good Graham Potter is tactically and how he sees the game, and he'll make multiple changes throughout the game. I don't think this. I mean, Sean Dyche did not have a very good second half here, because time and time again we were attacking down that right hand flank and they just didn't do anything to change it. And like both of goals came through there, and we had plenty of other chances to score again through coming through that flank. So you would have thought that they might have actually made a change there.
Yeah, but who cares?
This is true, certainly. But you know, I mean, it did seem slightly odd to me. Oh, here we go on exactly the same side again. And I mean, the goals are pretty much identical to a certain degree.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Tom,
there's only so much tinkering Sean Dyche can do with a 4-4-2, though. The tactical options at Burnley are slightly less, I think.
Let's go. Well, let's talk about the goals then.
Hey, hang on, Aidy. I think, sorry, before we do that, and you're right, they are. I mean, you can actually talk about one and might as well talk about the other at the same time. But I think Tom raises a really good point there is that for the likes of Sean Dyche and his relative lack of options, I mean, this is the point that people are worrying about. We mentioned it in the last couple of weeks, is that we have that level of adaptability, not in just the style, but in the personnel as well. Now, all right, putting Gross at left back is probably, you know, pushing it a bit, or putting Mwepo at right back like it did for the Getafe game is pushing it a bit. And like you say, one day it will happen that Sanchez will go up front with Steele in goal. But the issue is that with Potter, you say it was the tactical genius, but I think there's also, it's the background and the backup that he's got. And I'm talking about Ashworth and their group there that says, right, we're going to buy these players. And these players are the ones that are going to be adaptable enough. I wouldn't say they're jack of all trades, master of none. That's clearly not the case. But they're adaptable enough that they can actually play in those various positions and not look out of place. Some do, but others don't. I mean, could you actually tell me every single time as to whether Solly March is best at left wing back or over on the right wing? Is McAllister always best at number 10, or is he better sort of one of the support players, and so on and so forth? So, yeah. You know, I mean, rhetorical questions, but, you know, that's the point I'm making. Is following on Tom's point is that we do have that level of adaptability.
But, you know, you do want to see... like when you make subs, you want them to seem to have an impact. And my God, did they have an impact on this game? I mean,
could you say that coming, Tom?
To be brutally honest, at halftime, no. We all knew that there had to be changes, but I think, you know, that there was such a clear difference in energy and kind of approach from Burnley versus us in the first half that it just felt like a bridge too far to overcome. But to be fair, as soon as you saw the change and that first 2 minutes of the second half, kind of signaled that gave the belief. And again, a bit like the Man City game last year, as soon as we scored that first goal, the players believed that we were going to go on to win, and we believed that we were going to go on to win as well.
But the goal started. The first equaliser all started with Ibasima driving at the Burnley midfield. He flicked it out to the right, where a galloping Jakob Moda picks up the ball, and his cross is flicked home by Neil Morpai. And that was a much-needed goal for Neil as well. I mean,
that's his trademark sniffer number 9 goal. That's the sort of thing that we want to get. Make sure he gets in front of the defender, in front of the goalkeeper every time. He does do it now and again. He can do it. It's just days, for whatever reason, he doesn't. And this is one of those days where he did, and he got his reward for it. Good for him.
I think as well, it's quick moving football.
Yeah.
When the defence is on the back foot with Mope running forwards into them, he can get lost, and that's where he creates a space and finds the tap-in. It's almost when there's too much time and the defence is kind of set that he struggles more. And I just think it's so important that not only for him, but also for fans, that he scored in the first week.
Yeah, he enjoyed it, didn't he?
Yeah.
I'd be curious, Aidy, because you know these kind of stats. I mean, what is he on? He's probably on about 15 goals for us now. But how many of those are first-touch goals as opposed to control?
18 goals. It's actually 19 goals.
I'll take your word for it, but my point is that how many of those are... Well, one, I'd imagine that all of them are in the box. I can't think of any that are outside the box.
There was one against Wolves.
Okay. but how many of those are first touch? I mean, we'll probably talk about that next time, but therein lies the issue, is that sometimes when I think Tom's absolutely right, if he's given too much time to think about it, that's when, you know, just very, very quickly, very briefly, that's when the niggling doubt sets in. Whereas when he's doing the instinctive sniffer, 6-yard poacher, that's when we know he can do it best.
And he's a stadium player. We said, we've been saying it all last year, that, you know, he riffs off a crowd being there, and he certainly did that. And he was a long may that continue. But okay, let's quick. We've got to move on quickly. So again, identical goal, apart from it was Pascal Grace providing his customary assist for a late arriving Alexis McAllister, who had only been on the pitch for 2 minutes. My God, he enjoyed that as well.
Yeah, he did. That was great. Although I just want to add one thing to that. The cheeky jump from Neil Maupay to allow the ball to go under to get McAllister's shot in is undervalued, I think.
I didn't see that. I'll have to look that again.
Yeah. As the ball comes across, Maupay just jumps in the air and the ball goes under him for McAllister to slot it in. But yeah, again, quick moving football, great goal.
Okay. Well, you know, we came home with the 3 points, and we can't get too carried away from it. Let's face it, we've been to Burnley before and won the first game of the season, and that season didn't end up so well. So we've got to keep on keeping on.
Just 11 more wins required, mate, and we'll be okay.
Okay. But on that note, you're listening to the Albion Roar here on Radio Reverb, 97.2 FM, online at radioreverb.com, on DAB, and of course on our podcast. As usual, we're brought to you in association with the free and oldfootballshirts.com. Phil has provided us with a shirt of the week, which I'm not sure whether it's a football shirt or a cycling shirt, to be honest. But
it's a lot of advertising on it, isn't there?
It's, yeah. Tom, if you want to have a go at describing this little thing for me.
The first thought I had when I saw it, it's a bit like those third shirts that Puma released yesterday, in the sense of it's slightly in your face. Yeah. It you know, black with some gold on it. I, you know, the colours are great. But as you said, like the advertising, this great big yellow box in the middle, and then advertising everywhere. I mean, it's a billboard essentially, isn't it?
I'm just trying to work out what that pan thing is.
It's what we've got here is we've got a black T-shirt with gold V-neck on the collar and the cuffs. It's made by Kappa. The main thing that you've got is this Pam, and I think with the fact there's two leaves as part of that logo leads me to believe it is some kind of fruit or grocery chain or something like that. But what you've got is where the badge and the manufacturer are, below them there's two more adverts, and this is why where it looks so untidy is because they are on white patches which go onto the black shirt, and this is what makes it look an utter mess. Let's not even start on the sleeves, but Phil has mucked about with the badge, which is a kind of a rounded shield. It's not even a straight shield. There's three stars on it. It's red and white halves. It's only the fact that one of the patches says Band de Sion, which makes me think that this is a club from Southwest France.
Tom, do you have any ideas?
Absolutely not. I'm kind of being drawn in by the Black Sea piece behind it. But which kind of makes me think that it's kind of that Eastern...
I mean, from what you were saying earlier, I thought you might have more of a clue than Al on this, because, I mean, you might be going looking for some sort of microfiche or a red fox somewhere in this particular jersey. I'll tell you what it is. Your shirt of the week, and chosen for no particular reason, this is the third shirt from 2010 to 2011 of Swiss Super League side FCS Sion. Sion were formed in 1909, and they play at the Stade Tourbillon, which has a capacity of 14,500 fondue enthusiasts. Much of their early history was spent in the third or fourth tier of Swiss football. In 1962, they made it to the top flight and they spent the rest of their time between the top two leagues. Financial problems in 2003 meant that former footballer and businessman Christian Constantin saved the club from going out of business. He has had over 40 head coaches and since he took control, and has even taken the role of head coach twice himself during that time. Sounds like another club.
40 and 18 done. Years, is that?
Since 2000. Wow. Yeah. In 2008, he incurred the wrath of UEFA over a player transfer. And because they are only a Swiss club, they were hit with a full-on two-year transfer embargo and financial penalties. In 2011, they were expelled from the Europa League for fielding players who were ineligible in the qualifying rounds. So they're doing well there, aren't they? FIFA threatened to suspend the Swiss national side and all Swiss clubs from European competitions if the Swiss FA didn't penalise FC Sion for the rule violations. A 36-point deduction. 36 points? That's blimey.
Did they stay up?
No. was put in place for the 2011-2012 season, and somehow Sion managed to avoid relegation. Without the points deduction, they would have finished third.
Right.
There we go. So,
any links with Brighton?
A few UK links. Former Burnley and Rangers journeyman striker Carl Lafferty spent 2012-13 there. Everyone's favourite football pundit, Mark Bright, agreed in principle to join Sion in 1997 and began training with the team. But the club refused to pay the transfer fee for him and he never made appearance for him, leaving after only a few weeks.
That's a shame. I know. With Mark Bright in Switzerland, can't we?
Yeah, I know.
Sorry, I've got to mention this.
But actually, no, there is an Albion link. Sorry, it went on to this, the other page. There is a link. Under-23 striker Laurent Talage began his career with Sion before we snatched up in 2019. So there you go.
Fantastic. Actually, so talking about things that are protesting and FIFA getting upset, I don't know if you've seen this, is that FIFA are, well, it's the actual Norway football side are contemplating withdrawing from the World Cup, the 2022 World Cup, in protest at the behaviour of the Qatari people who are building the stadium. So obviously we know there's been, you know, well, we moan about health and safety here, but they could do with some over there. And hundreds, maybe thousands of people have died in the construction of those stadiums, which somewhere down the line, so many people have turned a blind eye to. And so Norway is actually making a stand of not just having things on their shirts, but actually contemplating withdrawing from the World Cup entirely, which could mean that FIFA, rather than actually thinking, oh, maybe they've got a point here, or at least listen to their concerns, are actually then going to suspend Norway from the 2026 World Cup and the 2024 Euros as well. So it's good to know that FIFA have their priorities in order.
Okay, well, let's move on then. Now, as many of you know, the North Stag Collective, or NSK, are known to most Albion fans as a group of people who like to bring as much noise and colour to anywhere that the Albion are playing. And Tom is, of course, a key figure within that collective. And Tom, you decided to actually bring out a physical fanzine.
Yeah. It's something that we've kind of been toying with for quite a while, to be honest. You know, the number of discussions and that we've had, and trying to get people to come up with ideas of what we could do and how to approach it, and they're really tough, it turns out. But you know, I think there's great history, isn't there, in football of fanzines. You look at some of the Brighton ones in terms of Goals Eye, TSLR and stuff, and it's something that's really been missed in the recent history. I mean, we've got Dogma that have just come out recently as well, and that's a superb fanzine, again, Brighton, and I think they're the ones that really kind of gave us a kick to do it, so they kind of inspired us there.
Sure, so give us a breakdown of the editorial considerations of the collective voice. I mean, because once upon a time you had Goals Eye, which was there as it was a little bit of lads banter and a little bit of lads humour, but when it got to the serious stuff of trying to get rid of Arntra and Bellotti, a story that we don't actually need to sort of actually, you know, do nowadays. So there we are as a Premier League side, you know, looking up further up. So what's the editorial considerations of the fanzine now?
I think it's to tell the story of the fans. I mean, you know, in this day and age, you can get all the tactical kind of considerations, reviews and analysis from everywhere. Whereas actually things that are cultural or fan-led or just kind of stories that, that haven't really been out there, that's where the fanzine is, and that's what we want to do. You know, we want to show who we are, basically, as Brighton supporters, and tell that story.
I mean, I just need to, I think, probably set a little bit of context here. Is that, I mean, certainly AD and I will remember this because we're knackered old people. Is where the fanzine movement grew out of, and we probably are talking about the late 80s here. I mean, at the time, there was obviously a lot of hooliganism. There was a lot of, you know, the right-wing incursion into football. Margaret Thatcher having had pretty much her fill of football hooliganism without realising actually it was society's problem, and still is, by the way, rather than football's own problem. And on the back of that, there was a kind of a backlash from, quote, decent football fans who actually wanted to write about football culture without the culture actually always being the one that's being written about in the mainstream media. I mean, there was humour thrown in there, there was silliness thrown in there, there was always in-jokes in there. Goalseye was on the back of that. There was Ann Smith Must Score came out about the same time, and we are talking about late 80s, early 90s. Yeah, by his own admission, Hartie stepped over the line a couple of times and got sort of, you know, slapped on the, well, not so much slapped on the wrist as punched in the face for it. But and as the times went on, we got to realise that it wasn't just sort of the humour that the fanzines needed. You know, it was a great focal point. This is pre-internet, a great focal point for the days that we had of Archer against Bolotti. And as technology has progressed and desktop publishing has made these sorts of things a lot easier, fanzines were also used, obviously, in the days of trying to get the stadium started. And found, but also that's when the, and so you've got this internet versus fanzine consideration, of which there's room for both in football culture and in culture generally, but so far internet has won the battle. But I think, as AD pointed out last week, it's nothing like as much fun to actually sit there and read a PDF on screen or even on your Kindle as to having something physical that A, you can read, you know, wherever it is you go, and B, as have it as part of your collective arsenal.
Yeah, and I think, you know, being able to put it down, pick it up, almost do it in bite sizes if you want, and just have it there. You know, I think Brian said it last week about they got the digital program. Even that's going digital. You know, there's not enough actual print, and there is something special about the smell of printed paper.
Oh yes,
as well. So
it's better for your eyes as well. I mean, actually looking at screens the whole time, which most of us do, we're doing it at work, we're always looking at laptops, we're looking at our phones. It's nice to actually give your eyes a break and actually hold something that isn't going to kill your eyes so much. And it's actually a tangible, and as Al said, it's collectible, and it's just something. It's just nice. I mean, we had this conversation with Andy Naylor, we've had it with Brian about the way that newspapers are going, and most of their sales are plummeting, and they're all trying to go online. So to have something coming out now that's actually a physical thing, it's actually a good time to do it because people are actually wanting it.
But culturally, it's also like the return of vinyl, isn't it? I mean, you know, yes,
I guess so. Yeah,
CDs and MP3s are all very well and good in digital, and they produce an amazing sound. But there's something. You know, we were a very, very emotional race. We are a very sentimental race, and we do like the things that we grew up with. And if that's going to be 33s and 45s, and if that's going to be a match programme printed, you know, in horrific colour, or if that's going to be something that's, you know, even your favourite sweets or your favourite smells from your childhood, there's nothing like that regression to actually put you in mind to actually want to do that. Now, I'm being a little over dramatic here, but...
Yeah, I know. I was just trying to work out, can you get digital smells?
Yes.
Digital sweets, that'd be a toughie.
If you've not been to the Musée des Sciences in Paris, mate, then... yeah, they had something like that. So, yeah, I mean, it's... So, Tom, with this... I mean, sorry, we're waxing lyrical about something you've produced, but it's actually really down to you to tell us what it is you produced. So if anyone was to, A, buy a copy, how would they do it, and B, what would they be reading?
Yes, sure. So what we're doing at the moment is it's time for kind of our membership renewal. So, you know, all of our members, they contribute to kind of getting new banners, building that kind of atmosphere and supporting kind of what NSK does. So it comes as a free gift in membership at the moment, but it will be available to buy through the NSK Big Cartel shop. Another part of modern football is all these restrictions coming in, right? So we're only allowed the A4 bag and it's all cashless and all of that. So that makes it hard for you to sell something, right? On the day. So I think we're going down the route of that, but we're hoping to find a way to sell it at the ground as well.
Have you got it in mind to, well, obviously you can sell it outside where the club has got jurisdiction. And I'm thinking the other side of the railway line here. I mean, I'm sure I'm probably telling you stuff you already know, but have you got it in mind to approach, to go into the pubs around Brighton Station?
Yeah, so that's something that we're looking at. I mean, one of the things that we also wanted to do with it that feels slightly strange in a fanzine was we've kind of put in a couple of nods to the Prince Albert and the Caxton and stuff like that. But they're all kind of places that we support on match days that have supported throughout COVID. And, you know, they've had a rough old time of it. So it's a way of kind of putting back to them. But for sure, we're looking to try and get it into places where people can. I suppose the best thing to do is keep an eye on our socials, which is NSKBHA. And that's where you'll get the information as to where you can buy it and access it.
And of course, not just the fanzine. There's an awful lot of other stuff you can buy from there as well, which is always inventive and always entertaining. So can you just give us that website address again?
Yeah, it's nskbha.bigcartel.com. There's all sorts of stickers. We've got a load of pin badges, everything from old shirts to Pascal Gross turn. To like Cantona kicking. There's a load of scarves, there's t-shirts. Yeah, there's all sorts. But, you know, what you'll find is kind of slightly edgy, funny stuff. So, you know, one of my personal favourites is a half and half scarf, which has no place in football. But when it's half Brighton, half Hove, it's kind of acceptable.
That's a gag we've been telling for years. Absolutely. We've got one. It's one artist Brighton, the other artist Hove.
Listen, exactly.
we've had the privilege of being sent a review copy. Now, we could tell you what's in it, but actually, I think, you know, just give the fans of your customers a flavour of what you're picking up.
Yeah, so there is a little nod to last season and our favourite thing of XG, which is kind of a bit of a joke, especially I bang on about stats amongst everyone and they all have a go at me about it. So I had a little dig at them by writing an article about statistics. We've got Cowdy in there. He's contributed. There's some stuff around kind of where football is. So what football actually means and how we can kind of come through it. There's a look at kind of the wealth of football and kind of how that's reared its ugly head with the Super League and other kind of elements of it. There's also kind of an introduction to some of the friendships that we have in the NSK with teams in Italy and Spain. Obviously there's also some stuff about beer and pubs.
I don't like beer.
I'll buy you coffees.
Exactly. So it's quite varied and it's predominantly culture based and just kind of a view on football at the moment.
You're absolutely knackered from doing this, aren't you? You'd rather take a short holiday and then start selling it.
Well,
do you have a nice holiday? Right, now start selling it.
it's great. Just go find it. No,
yeah, absolutely.
That will do. That will do.
So the collective voice is available from NSK Cartel, and we'll give you the website address at the end of the show again. And episode issue one is out now, and do yourself a favour and buy a copy because it's absolutely fantastic.
Okay. Well, this evening or Saturday night, depending on when you're listening to this, sees the Amex back to full capacity. We've been speaking about this before, and we think that it's going to be emotional. I mean, I said in the intro that, you know, it's going to be the first time that people have seen friends or family. And, you know, I mentioned nodding acquaintances there as well. People you don't normally see or you haven't got their phone number or would bring up. But it's like, hello, mate, nice to see you. And it's going to be really emotional, like similar to that of that first game back against Doncaster 10 years ago.
I think there will be an element of that. Don't get me wrong, I always get emotional for a Brighton versus Watford game, but...
we're going to knit your sweets and lollipops.
that is going back. But there is a slight difference here. Like I say, you and I went through that COVID thing of watching the games in an empty stadium. So, yeah, having it in a full stadium is going to be great again. One, I just hope, that there are people who were previously at the game that will be there, you know, this time, that either they haven't been put off or that we've lost them on this journey. I mean, I don't know how many there are, but I mean, I know it sounds a bit maudlin and a bit grisly, but, you know, we could come back to something where we think, well, so-and-so's not here. I haven't seen so-and-so. But, yes, it would be great to see people that you're on nodding acquaintance with. I think that probably all of us have maybe added a little timber. So getting upstairs in the West Stand Upper is going to be... There's going to be a little bit more wheezing, I think. But the pies and the pints are going to be welcome nonetheless. It's going to be emotional, but I kind of feel... My approach to it at the moment is... It feels as though it's going to be a little bit weird. It is now finally the... Well, here we are. You know, there's even the whole thing of... Are we ready for this? And I'm not trying to get political about this, but are we ready for it? I hope we are. The club's robust way of checking that everyone is okay before they go in. And I really, really hope that there's very, very few, minimal people who actually are going to refuse to be checked or to adhere to the club's and the government's guidelines on this. So I'm hoping everyone does play ball. But once we're inside, then... Seeing as what we did for the Brighton Man City game and how we cheered the team along and how that can make all the effects, I'm hoping that we can do exactly the same on Saturday and that all the things that we had about missing easy open goals will be a thing of the past and that we can actually almost encourage the ball in itself. It's going to be a little weird, I think. I think more weird than emotional, I genuinely do.
Okay, Tom?
Yeah, I think, you know, Monday, Saturday against Burnley. I don't know why Monday came in there. Saturday against Burnley was a weird experience, and it didn't help going behind kind of so quickly. But the atmosphere picked up in the second half for sure. And I just hope that, you know, people are going to get behind the team, make a real racket in the stadium. I think, you know, 8,500 for that Man City game sounded like 30,000. Now let's actually have 30,000 sounding like 60,000. You know, I think, you know, we've just got to come together and get behind the team.
Can we be so motivated as if we're playing, as it's, I say only, is only Watford playing? Do you think we can get as motivated? Would it have helped if we started up with a big club?
No, I think it a lot of it for me comes down to performance on the pitch. I think if the team starts quick, the atmosphere always seems to pick up, regardless of who we're playing. Yeah. And I think that's kind of the important thing. And that's the bridge that we've got to come over. We've got to get it more constant, not just relying on the team for energy.
I don't think that the opposition has got any relevance to this at all. I mean, basically, it's a Premier League game, you know, and a lot of people haven't been to one for a very, very long time.
Yeah,
it doesn't matter whether it's Watford or Stoke or Burnley or Accrington Stanley. It would be...
Now you're pushing it.
It would be, you know, it's just delight. People are just going to be delighted to be back. Tom?
Yeah. I think a 5:30 kickoff might help with the atmosphere as well. You know,
what
people
you say,
have had
Tom?
A couple more hours in the pub. Good bit of lubrication on the throat.
Yeah, the 5:30 kickoffs would not really great favours of mine and ours, because basically we're not able to get back into the studio just yet, but we used to be live for a home game. We'd be live in the studio at 12, finish at 1, and then we'd have like 4 hours to kill.
It's the obligation of being in town at 1 o'clock rather than saying, right, let's meet up at 2:30. It's having to be in town at 1 o'clock, and therefore the almost forced compulsion with a gun to head, and we're back to Tom's recruitment in Geneva, maybe a ray gun to the head, of going to the pub.
You know, exactly.
I mean, to be honest, it's the full stadium is one thing, but it's the entire Saturday culture of whatever it is your previous, your rites of passage were, whatever it was your routine was on Saturday, whether it was getting up, having a particular, putting certain clothes on, having a particular breakfast, going to a particular pub to meet some particular, and so on. This routine has the wherewithal to return on this Saturday. And I think more than a full stadium, that's the bit that I think that people are going to most look forward to, Tom.
Yeah, I agree. I think as well, though, it's important to note that I think Saturday is going to be really difficult for some people.
Yes.
You know, myself, one of the people that I sit next to, it passed away last year. I've had other friends that have passed away in that time, because it's been such a long time, and that's going to impact it as well and heighten the emotions. And I think just in general, it's a big day on Saturday for a number of reasons, whether it's the return to some sense of normality, whatever that is, but also to almost kind of honor those.
Yeah, let's face it, there are going to be people that are going to be very worried about going back to in close environments with people, a packed train, a packed stadium, packed concourses. You know, I personally am still wearing masks in those sort of situations.
Well, likewise.
So, you know, it's a case of like still being sensible and you know, and respecting everybody else.
AD, I wonder if everyone else did wear a mask, what 25,000 people singing might sound like.
Slower.
Do it slower. Okay, yeah.
Slower.
And but, then comes the mask in.
We are just about to run out of time. So, Tom, just quickly, just tell us where you can get the new fanzine from.
Yep. So head over to nskbha.bigcartel.com or head over to our socials on Twitter and Instagram, both for NSKBHA. And there you'll find all the kind of latest information. And hopefully when we get them in, you'll find it there.
Fantastic.
Okay. Well, that's fantastic. Yep. So good luck with all of that. And thank you, of course, to Alan Ware. Thank you to Tom Hyland. I've been AD Packham. This has been the Albion Raw here on Radio Reverb 97.2 FM, online at radioreverb.com, on DAB, and of course on our podcast. We didn't have time to talk about Tommy Elphick. Oh, well, good job he's on the show next week, eh? See you then. Thanks for listening. Bye.